step across the water course to pull out my own chair. And he says I always need to have the best place everywhere, because I'm a woman. Well, no one ever carried me or gave me the best place or helped me in the carriages or over the mill.
One of the great moments in my life as a mother was when I was having some argument with my daughter. She must have been about 5 or 6. And she said, "And ain't I a woman?" That song gives me chills. I'm Judy Pasternak, and all of us women are more than half the world. It may interest you to know that Mayor Beam proclaimed this week, this morning he did this, I think, at least he was scheduled to do it. I haven't heard whether he actually did it or not. He was to proclaim this Women in Business Week in association with the Association of New York Women Business Owners or something. And there are activities going on all week having to do with women in business. Did I get that right? Yes, the New York Association of Women Business Owners is the sponsor of this. And there's all kinds of stuff going on, panels all over the place. I am not going to read all of them. There are films going on in the evenings at various libraries. Joyce at 34, which is a movie about a filmmaker, is playing... Oh, sorry, that was last night. Women in Communication, about three women in communication, a disc jockey, a filmmaker, and a journalist, is playing tonight at the 58th Street Library at 127 East 58th Street at 6 o'clock. And on Wednesday night, tomorrow night, there are two of them. At 6 o'clock, you can see Fear Woman, which is about three women in Ghana, a chieftain, a judge, and a businesswoman and politician. That's four. I can't figure that out either. But that's what it says at the County Cullen Library, 104 West 136th Street. And at 7 tonight, There's a film called Imogene Cunningham, Photographer, at the Jefferson Market Library on 6th Avenue in Greenwich Village. And all week long, there is an exposition called Women in Business Making It in New York, Exposition 77, at the Statler Hilton Hotel. Various women-owned businesses in New York are going to have booths there, including, I know, some small businesses, some women that are in feminist businesses. I know Wise Woman Enterprises, the record company, has a booth there. There are also things going on at Macy's in Herald Square all week. Money talks and money management programs. And there's something going on every day at the First Women's Bank on 57th Street called Success Sandwiched In. It's a lunchtime thing. It goes on at noon every day this week, Monday through Friday, today through Friday. I just got a note that says that film Fear Woman has been shown on television and is supposed to be a great movie. So if you are uptown and you want to see that, that's at the County Cullen Library at 104 West 136th Street tonight at 6:30, half an hour after this program is over. It's also not the only women and working event of the week. Women Office Workers, WOW, is having a conference on Saturday at the High School of Art and Design, the one that's at 57th Street and 2nd Avenue. It starts at 9:30 in the morning, and there'll be workshops on all kinds of topics relating to women doing office work, including your legal rights and union organizing, which is pretty absent in most women's office work, women office working jobs. It's always been a real hard field to organize. Since all this stuff is going on this week about women and one kind of work or another, you might think that I would be glad to talk about that for a change, because I always talk about women and work. But I am not. In fact, perversely. Well, let's put it this way. I opened the paper this morning and discovered that even the news had an article about this being Women in Business Week. So, in some ways, feminism has made it. We have made certain kinds of gains. 10 years ago, say, you would not have known from the pages of the Daily News that there was such a thing as women in business, at least not enough to have a citywide event about. We were invisible as business owners, and we have become visible. And I guess, as I said, that's a gain. And in order to keep us from getting too carried away by our gains today, I wanted to talk about some of the backlash against the women's movement.
This song is addressed to my sisters. Any man who is present may listen. Any priest, any public official, any physician. But it gives him no license to touch us. We make the decision. Me and Lydia, Rosie and Josie and Dee, we handle these matters ourselves. You'd better believe, or you'd better leave. Rosie Jane,
talk about abortion.
I'd had an extra shot on top of what I got. In a word, I was drunk, so was doctor's bill, and I forgot to take my pill. I guess it was God's will.
We're going to talk about abortion.
What in heaven's name were you thinking of, Rosie Jane? Was it love? When that baby is a child, it will suffer from neglect, be picked upon and pecked, and run over and wrecked, and its head will be crowned with the thorn. But while it's inside her, it must remain intact, and it cannot be murdered till it's born. Rosie Jane, what in heaven's name were you thinking of, Rosie Jane? Was it love?
Little chronology here. In 1961, I had an illegal abortion. Luckily, I was a middle class young woman, and I didn't have a lot of trouble digging up the $1,000 it cost. It was a heavy experience. Yeah, I was a white middle-class woman, and I didn't have a lot of trouble not only digging up the $1,000, but finding an expensive gynecologist, Park Avenue gynecologist, who charged me $1,000 and took fairly good care of me medically, and I knew he would, so I wasn't quite afraid for my life. I didn't have any anesthesia because he couldn't afford to risk his career by having an anesthesiologist around. It wasn't the worst thing that ever happened to me. In 1970, is that 9 years later, abortions became legal in New York State. What did I have then? I had a year and a half old baby. I wasn't planning on having any more. The whole thing, I guess, seemed kind of academic to me. It was I noted ruefully that my life would not have been as hard 9 years before if they had been legal, but, it was all right. And in 72, I added an extra dramatic flair to the breakup of my marriage by getting pregnant by my husband, just as we were trying to iron out the details of separating. And almost our last activity together was going to be that I was going to get my tubes tied, but instead I had to have this fast, nifty, easy, early legal abortion. Again, I was even more middle class then. I was a middle class housewife. And it was all simple. Turned out not to be any fun, but it was simple. And in 1973, when I was already a real, deeply involved in the women's movement, in the struggle for whatever you want, women's liberation, women's rights, the Supreme Court declared that the abortions were legal all over the country within certain limitations. And we had great, great rejoicing in the women's movement because we had one something major. We hadn't won all of what we were struggling for. I was just given a note that says it was on January 22nd, 1973. Going on 5 years ago. But they didn't say, the Supreme Court did not say, that abortion was outside the provenance of the law. They said that within certain limitations, within a certain time limit, it was legal if it was performed by doctors, that states could make other laws about the time limits. It was not the hands off our bodies that many of us thought we were fighting for. It was not the attitude that Malvina Reynolds was just singing about. We take care of this by ourselves. We make our own decisions about it. It was 9 men deciding that it was all right under these circumstances. Not all right under those circumstances. And clearly reserving the right to make further decisions about it. About women's bodies and our lives. And I guess now we can say this was predictable. At the time, it didn't seem predictable. As I said, it seemed like a victory. It seemed like feminism was carrying us in one direction, and if we didn't have hands off our bodies yet, we had victory number one in what would be a series. And I think a lot of us were not ready for the backlash. I know that I should have known better. I've been involved in political struggle all my life, and I know damn well that when you bleep around with the status quo fights back as hard as it can. The status quo meaning people who have privileges. In this case, people have privileges to make decisions about other people's lives and what happens to them. And in the last year or two, the backlash has made itself evident, the backlash against feminism, which in some ways, in some pieces of the movement, has allied itself with the struggle for gay rights. And there's been a backlash against that in Florida. There's been backlash expressed in the struggle over the International Women's Year conferences statewide. I understand that the Mississippi delegation that will be going to Houston on November 21st is carrying a set of resolutions that are against abortion, against welfare, against gay rights, and against a couple of other things that I've forgotten. Specifically, speaking of abortion, the backlash has taken a couple of forms. In June of this year, the Supreme Court ruled that the states had the right not to pay their share of Medicaid bills for abortions. That is, that although abortion is legal, no state is obliged to pay the state share. Medicaid is funded usually by federal funds, state funds, and local funds. And the Supreme Court ruled that the states have the right to say whether or not they're going to pay their share of those funds. If they don't, of course, that means that the local municipality has a much larger bill to pay. And then also in June, Congress passed an amendment, the Hyde Amendment, to a health education welfare bill. Now, the Senate and the House of Representatives passed two different bills, and they haven't yet ironed out the differences. But basically, they both forbid the federal share of Medicaid funds for abortions, except under extremely narrow, if they're medically necessary. The Senate version of the bill allows federal funds to pay for it. the House version, I understand, does not even allow payment of the Medicaid bill, the federal portion of it, if a woman has been raped and wants to have an abortion. Now, on the one hand, that those bills, what they affect immediately is poor women's ability to have abortions performed by doctors. What they also do is reinforce the idea that the Senate, which is at the moment, what is it, 99% male? I don't remember. 100%. And the House of Representatives, which is over 90% male, and the Supreme Court, which is 100% male, have the rights to make those decisions, those evaluations. I want to say here that I cannot make abortion an absolutely simple issue. I have mixed feelings about it at the borderline point, and that keeps getting earlier and earlier in pregnancies, where a fetus becomes viable. I know that I would have to be pretty hard-pressed before I could have a six-month abortion. And I hope that as time goes on, as we keep fighting for more rights to control our own bodies, more participation in what happens to our bodies, more women working in research so that we can get better kinds of contraceptives, more and better ways of dealing with more structures, family structures, or alternatives to the family. I would hope that abortion in some future time is not a real important thing either way. But it seems to me that right now it's real urgent that we convince the world that legislative bodies and judicial bodies composed of men cannot sit around forever and make declarations of what goes on inside our bodies in our most private places. So I guess I have strong feelings about it all, even though they're not entirely simple. Sometimes the music makes it simpler.
No room, no room, no room, said the Mad Hatter. His brain had turned to batter from eating tuna fish or swordfish or some such matter. Something he ate, to be sure. Don't bring another baby in. The Duchess will feed it pepper, or it might turn into a pig, because it knows no better. No room, no room, no room, no room at the table. Adding another ounce might make one too many, and the teapot empty, not enough crumpets to go round. Don't bring another baby in. The Duchess will feed it pepper, or it might turn into a pig, because it knows no better. No room, no room, no room. Holy is the fetus. But babies once born are simply human. And if they die in the streets of Calcutta, no one will notice but their mom. And ain't that just like a woman? Don't bring another baby in. The Duchess will feed it pepper, or it might turn into a pig because it knows no better. No room.
That was Malvina Reynolds again, who I think one of the many reasons I like playing Malvina Reynolds, one is that she writes real, real nice songs. The other is that it's a permanent reminder to us, an ongoing reminder that young people and young women don't have a priority on art or on social concern. She just keeps on turning them out. I would like to talk about abortion with you. For all of us together to share our experiences, to hear what you're feeling about it and what you've been through and what you want and what you think the effect of the new legislation is going to be on your life and on the lives of other women. The phone number is 371-5200. And I would especially like to hear from women. I would like to hear from women who feel that their lives were easier during those, what was it, 4 years? That the right to abortion was relatively unimpeded in this city. Okay. WBAI, you're on the air.
I just want to say that you're not very clear on radio.
I'm not very... Can you turn your radio down?
Could you turn up your volume on the radio so you can hear you better?
Turn up the volume? Okay. Is that better? Oh, now you're not listening because you turned it down. Okay, we will turn it up. Thank you. WBAI, you're on the air.
Hi. I must be on delay because someone else was on the air.
Yes. Turn down your radio and then you won't get confused.
Okay, it's off. I also have had an experience perhaps similar to yours. In 1959, I went through an illegal New York City upper-middle-class abortion. And the one vivid thing about it was the physician in his 60s who was doing it said, "Are you sure from now on you'll promise me you'll be a good girl and not let this happen again?"
Yeah, that was my doctor's attitude, too. In fact, he took enormously better post-op care of me than I had expected from an illegal abortion. Although he extracted all kinds of promises from me not to tell anybody who had done it, he made an appointment with me for not only a checkup, but insisted on making sure that I knew what I was doing with birth control after that. But he was real patronizing, yeah.
Yeah, and the second experience was the spring when my obstetrician was out of town. She, her office nurse, gave me the name of a place on Long Island which I could contact for an abortion, and I called the office at this given number.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed to have been a laboratory which was used during the day for lab work. And the young woman who answered the phone said, "You must be here at 7 a.m. because we have a day of lab work to do. We'll fit you in before we start it." Fortunately, I aborted naturally and didn't have to go through that because it sounded like an absolute animal farm or zoo. But I'm all for legal abortion for all women.
I'm for them, but I have to say that when we struggle to get control over our own bodies, It also seems to me it's real important that we start trying to get control of facilities as well, not only the legal right to control our own bodies, but the control of facilities for things like abortion, because I had a similar experience to yours in 72. I was in this situation where, because it was legal, my male obstetrician gynecologist had like three stretchers lined up outside the operating room and earned $750 in three quarters of an hour by doing us, you know, one, two, three. It was real dehumanizing, and I think it felt to me at the time he had been a real supportive doctor when I was having babies, and it seemed to me that to some extent he was punishing me for choosing to take my life in my own hands that way.
Right.
And that he should not, in fact, have been doing that kind of work.
Well, I found the answer to that for me was with female doctors.
Yeah, well...
There's a very different rapport, and there's a very different attitude. And if you have a feminist female doctor, you're in a very different place when you reach that problem.
When I started seeing that doctor in 1966,
yeah.
One would not have known... When one would not have imagined a feminist gynecologist or known how to find her.
Yeah.
You know,
there are ways nowadays to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the differences.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you for calling.
For your program very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, we are talking about our abortion experiences here. I would really like to hear from women who have had Medicaid abortions, and if by any chance you had both kinds, if you had a legal Medicaid one and previously had the other kind, I'd like to hear what the difference was. Also, the phone number is 371-5200. WBAI, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Well, when you were talking, I haven't had experiences with Medicaid abortions, but the illegal kind, definitely. And, you know, at the time, I wasn't too worldly wise, and I walked into this doctor's office down near Gramercy Park.
When was this?
You know, this was about 6-7 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And he's telling you, I'll never forget it, really. It takes a while to just tell you about it. I didn't know if he was an abortionist or not, but somebody told me he might be.
Uh-huh.
And after going through this whole thing, you know, he looks at me and he says, well, I hope you fall down. I still can't say it. I hope you fall downstairs and lose the baby, but there's nothing he could do for me, you know? And I remember walking out of that office and going into Gramercy Park and sitting there and getting locked in.
Oh, my.
And, you know, like, if this is the kind of thing that I was old enough, finally I integrated it into my total experiences, but if this is the kind of thing that has to happen to young girls, you know, I think, God, if it should ever happen to somebody 17, 18, 19, you know, really young.
It does, all the time.
Yeah,
it was bad.
And then finally, when met up with this doctor through a friend of mine that was a nurse, and, you know, the whole thing is just totally a terrible experience. I mean, it's just... To take this away from women, and the thing is, like, today, if it was me going through it again today, I would probably have the child and raise it. And at the time, bringing that point up to my mother, her answer is, but you can't do that to your two sisters, they're young unmarried girls. You know what I mean? So, like, the pressures on people and the difficulties that are put in women's ways, in women's paths,
yeah.
the burdens are incredible. And on young girls, it's just too much.
Yeah, it sounds like what you went through was you were squeezed between a law saying you didn't have the right to make decisions about yourself and your family saying that you had to worry first about your
sisters.
Yeah, and somehow there was no room for you in there.
Of all those problems, you're faced with these doctors, and I'm sure my experience is far from unique, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. But anyway, I just thought I'd share it because if people think that they're just fighting for a useless thing when they fight for legal abortions, this is the kind of thing that happens to people when we don't have them, and we must fight for them. And so it's good that shows like yours are on where people can talk about it and share. Okay,
thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for calling. those are the kinds of things that happen to us. I know that far more horrible things have happened to, especially to poor women, when they didn't have access to legal abortion. We have songs about that too.
Master, your child is born. Where will your pleasure lie? Is it a son? No, sir, it's a daughter. Then leave it outside to die. Hey, Lolo, who's gonna know that another girl child's gone? Hey, Lie, nobody will cry, it's only a girl child gone. Constable, that woman told me she was free to do as she willed. She's a threat to the church, she's a threat to the state. She's a witch, she must be killed. Hey, Lolo, who's gonna know that 9 million women died? Hey, there, nobody will care if 9 million women died. That girl who was raped and shot last night, if they go out, they've got to pay. She was too good looking, she got what she deserved. She probably liked it anyway. Hey, Lolo, who's gonna know that another woman's gone? Hey, Lie, nobody will cry, it's only a woman gone. Let's keep abortion illegal. With life, we must not toy. She's not as important as that bundle of cells. Besides, it might be a boy. Hey, Lolo, who's gonna know that today 5 sisters died? Hey, Lie, who's gonna cry if today 5 sisters died?
I have a sense of deja vu about all of this. I came into the women's movement in the very early 70s. Over the struggle for legal abortion. That song, which is by Jody Aleson, was written in 71. And I guess in late 72, when I was first living in New York and first a member of New York Radical Feminists, we were part of a coalition for, what was it called at the time? Women's Coalition, Women's National Action, Abortion Action Coalition, I think. And I think that the reason that a lot of us on WBAI have been talking about this recently is that I think we all have to combat in ourselves. I have to in myself fight against a kind of boredom with the whole issue feeling. But we solved that already. That was done with in 73. We don't have to do that anymore. There's a new coalition now. It's called CARASA. It's the Coalition for Abortion Rights and Against Sterilization Abuse. So that it's really aimed at women's rights to control our own bodies. And it is organizing again, for this struggle again. And it's, I think we just have to remember that it is not going to be simple to change the the structures that have evolved over 2,000 years, I guess. Since the Renaissance. Majority Report had an interesting article a few weeks ago pointing out that up until the 16th century, most of the popes had never taken a stand against abortion per se. And in fact, some of them had specified that it was only wrong if it was after, oh, I don't know, the first 4 months or 5 months and things like that. But there was no, certainly there was nothing like a uniform stand against it. The phone number here is 371-5200. And if you haven't noticed, we are talking about abortion. You can get in touch with Carassa through HealthRight, which you can look up in the phone book. I am ashamed to say that I did not bring the phone number in here with me. I was running around doing the things that you do before a program, and I forgot to get it. But there is a phone number that HealthRight has that says what is going on in the struggle over women's health issues in general. We all would like to get past it, to have it as a given that we have certain rights. I think for those of you who are not sure we have those rights, I would like to point out that up until pretty recently, women were assumed not to have rights over their own earnings either. And there are real changes required in the way people think about women and in the way women think about themselves. Somebody is about to provide me, I think, with that phone number. HealthRight is 674-3660. And they have more information about this. They're a women's health organization. Did I say that the phone number here is 371-5200? Have you had an abortion lately? And do you want to tell us about it? And how was it? How did they treat you? And how do you think they would have treated you? Somebody would have treated you if it wasn't legal. There was one thing I did not tell about my adventure in 1961. Before I found that doctor, it was not easy. I said I was lucky to find him because I was, you know, and finding him was a function of being middle class, but even then it wasn't easy. And I was, one night, somebody had given me a phone number. It was January. It was real cold and yucky and snowy. And I took a bus to New Jersey and got off the bus and then had to take a taxi to an apartment house. And I guess I didn't even know where I had been going until the last minute before that. Certainly no one else I knew where I was. I was just turned 21 at the time. And I knew that the person I was going to see was not a doctor. I didn't have any money with me because I had wanted to see her first and talk to her first. I wasn't sure if she was expecting me to bring it. I was really somewhat befuddled about what I was doing there. And I buzzed to get into the apartment building, and I was buzzed in. And I went upstairs in the elevator and rang the door buzzer. And the door swung open, and there was a man standing there, and I knew very quickly, not quick enough to run, but I knew that he was a cop. And he took my arm and said, "Come right in, honey." And I came in, and there were a lot of people sitting around there. And that was it. They were trying to bust up this abortion ring. And what they wanted from me was a statement of who her confederates were so that they would have the people who had tipped me off to her, too. It was... I didn't give them the statement. We argued about it till well past midnight. I couldn't call my father because I was afraid. He had a fairly responsible position at the time, and I was afraid if it got into the press or something, I didn't want to involve him. When I left, when they let us go, I got a lift back to Manhattan from two of the people who had been there, who were, I forget how I knew that that's what they did, but they were very obviously an airline pilot and a stewardess. And for the whole ride from New Jersey back into Manhattan, they argued about what they were going to do next. And it was kind of clear that what he would like to do next would be forget her. Forget that he had been involved in this. Forget that he had any part of it. And that she was pretty scared that that was what he was going to do. And we didn't talk about it any. But I knew that like me, you know, they didn't know where else to go next. And I say that knowing that I was insulated by knowing that probably nothing very awful was going to happen to me somewhere. I was going to find some medically qualified person to do it. It's unimaginable to me what that whole experience would have been like if I hadn't known that whatever, I was going to be able to raise that money. We all, in that car, felt like criminals. That was the other really hard part. The officer who had been talking to me kind of extracted tried to extract an oath from me that I was going to go home and take my punishment like a good girl or something. I knew people who had better experiences than that. I knew people who had worse experiences at the time. The part of the money that I had for that abortion, I got from a friend of mine who had a fairly large sum of money for one, and then had gone bargain hunting so she wouldn't need to use all that money, and had wound up in the hospital with a lot of hemorrhaging and a lot of infection because she had found a bargain abortionist. And she gave me all the rest of the money that she had originally for her abortion. She said, take it, pay it back when you can. If it's 10 years from now, pay it back 10 years from now, but don't go looking for a bargain. In 72, in fact, I had a choice. I could have looked for a bargain, and it would have been a doctor. I mean, the bargain would have been an abortion clinic instead of doing it with a private doctor the way I did. But in 61, the bargain meant you found somebody who wasn't a doctor. And they did whatever it was they thought or you thought would do the trick. It also meant, this is a kind of almost parenthesis here. What it meant, I think, for a lot of women when abortions were illegal was that they had much later abortions. That the length of time it took to find an abortionist meant that women were having 3 and 4 month abortions. In 72, I couldn't have been more than 3 weeks pregnant. I happened to be going to my doctor, and I happened to say my period was about 3 days late. And his secretary did an instant pregnancy test, and I was in the hospital the next day. 2 days later. I think it took 2 days. But I think that when we talk about it, that's something we often forget, is that among the many awful things that happen from illegal abortions, part of the higher rate of complications is a function of having to find the right grapevine and the length of time that takes, and the fact that the abortions are much later. The phone number here is 371-5200, and I have to admit that these are heavy experiences to talk about. Some of them were real hard for me, and I would like to hear from other women about what's happened to them. WBAI, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to say I admire your courage in talking about, you know.
Thank you.
I went through an illegal abortion in 1967.
Mm-hmm.
And in New Jersey, where it was a deal of going to some woman's house, and she did something, and then I came out and had a miscarriage.
Mm-hmm.
And her advice was to drink gin and not to sleep, to stay up all night and walk a lot.
And
when it finally happened, then I went into childbed fever.
Yeah.
And, you know, went into a very high fever and chills. And a friend of mine stayed with me in somebody else's apartment, sat on my stomach to keep me from shaking too much.
Jeez. Yeah.
And I called a doctor I knew and told him I had a bad cold. And he gave me penicillin over the phone. So I understand what you're talking about. You know?
What was that, 10 years ago, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. You hadn't realized it was that long ago?
No.
It's still with you real vivid.
I thought I'd gotten over it until you started talking about it. You know, I understand what you're saying, you know.
Yeah.
It's a heavy duty thing, and
it's hard.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how much of it is hard on us, because we were, you know, we did see it as criminal, at least for a lot of years. I'm not sure.
A lot of it is moral. A lot of it is moral, you know. I mean, I flushed the baby down the toilet.
It wasn't a baby.
Well, I was 5 months pregnant.
Oh.
Know that. I was new into the whole thing. And when I had the miscarriage, I was alone in the bathroom, you know. And that was it.
Yeah.
So, this whole thing about whether or not it's right or wrong, obviously nobody wants to have an abortion. You know, obviously it's wrong, but it should be wrong personally.
It's even hard to say that. It's hard to say, I don't know how we can say obviously it's wrong. It seems to me that it's not, that is not obvious, that it's more complex. That
if we're here to live, you know, we're pro-life.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's wrong, but it doesn't make anybody feel good.
No, it doesn't. I don't know. As I said, I don't know how much of how bad we feel is a function of it having been criminal. I wonder.
I never thought about the criminal aspect of it at all.
You may not have thought about it, but you sure had heard a lot about it.
No, I hadn't. You know. And even now, I'm just not I just don't think in those terms.
Mm-hmm.
It had a lot to do with family, and it had a lot to do with friends.
Mm-hmm.
I never thought about what the government would think about it, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, except that you still did have to call that doctor and tell him you had a cold.
Yeah.
You couldn't tell him what it was. You couldn't be treated.
That's true.
For what was wrong with you.
Yeah.
I mean, that is a real heavy thing, to be sick.
Yeah.
And not be able to tell a doctor what you're sick with.
Yeah, right. I guess that you're right, you know. That was the big fear that...
I had a friend who was trying to have a baby for years and kept having spontaneous abortions.
Yeah.
And one of them, she went to the hospital to be treated while she was miscarrying. And a doctor stood over her for hours and said, I know that you've done something to get rid of this. Tell me what you did or who did it with you.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and there she was.
Yeah, right.
At that particular time, being told she was a criminal when, in fact, she wasn't guilty of what she was being charged with.
Yeah, right. That's.
But in certain senses.
Well, think about that.
Yeah.
I was so afraid of dying that I didn't even think of that.
Yeah.
Jail. What would they do? Put you in jail?
They hardly ever have prosecuted women, actually. What they prosecuted was doctors or the people who do it. But that it sat there over our heads, you know, they could. There have been prosecutions once in a while. Yeah.
Crazy.
Okay,
yep. Well, anyway, I just wanted to thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for calling.
Okay,
Kev. Bye-bye. WBAI, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I have another kind of horror story from that time. The woman I was involved with, I had an IUD, and it was put in by the man who had invented this IUD. I don't know if I should mention his name on the air.
Probably not.
But he, when she told him that she was pregnant, he told her to go horseback riding and try to induce bleeding. So we went horseback riding, and the horseback riding people tried to teach her how to ride. So I was the one who was getting bumped around on my horse while she learned how to ride, but didn't induce bleeding. So he took her to his office, and he induced bleeding himself, and then had her put into a hospital, and then performed a legal abortion.
Mm-hmm.
She was now miscarrying.
Yeah.
But he did this because he wanted to keep the record for his IUD at a high rate. In other words, she became pregnant with the IUD in.
Mm-hmm.
And by doing it this way, it wasn't a reported pregnancy. And I imagine that there were all sorts of other things like this that went on at that time, too. It was just, it's so hard to, having been through it even as a man involved in this, to think of that period and what women were going through, and to think that there are still people who want to return to that, it's terribly frightening to me.
I mean,
I want you to know that it isn't that, of course, it's really a woman's problem in the sense that they wind up having to go through the experience emotionally and everything like that. But there are many men who also do feel that that's a horrible thing and they never want it to happen again.
And it touches your lives.
Yes,
you know.
Well, of course, especially if it's somebody who you love.
Yeah.
That's all I wanted to say.
Okay, thank you for calling.
Bye.
Bye-bye. I speaking of the struggle to control our own rights over our own bodies, I had another friend who had an IUD and had problems with it. And every time she went to the doctor and said, the doctor who had put it in, I think it was one of the clinics, and said, please remove this. I've been infected and a few other nasty things and in pain and bleeding ever since it was put in. They kept telling her no. They wouldn't take it out. She had to give it more time, and they would refuse to take it out. And then when she went to other doctors and said, please remove that, they said, we didn't put it in. And finally, she got her old family doctor to take it out by getting up on his examining table and telling him that if he didn't take it out right then, she was going to, right then. And that was the threat that worked. Once she threatened to actually take control that way, even though, of course, not knowing how to do it, she probably would have hurt herself, but that was it. That got attention. And this is WBAI New York. That one reminds me of another piece of my abortion story, although this is not entirely relevant to its being an abortion. In 72, when I was in the hospital, I had been given very minimal anesthesia. And so I was awake pretty quickly, but they had me in the recovery room. And then there was nobody there to take me out of the recovery room. So I was sitting there. in with people who had just had major surgery and were moaning and unconscious and drooling and other things. If you've never been awake in a recovery room, I will tell you, it is a nightmare. I'm sure it was more of a nightmare for the other patients, but it was a different kind of nightmare for me. And I was trying to persuade the nurses in attendance that I was recovered and, in fact, didn't need to be there anymore. And they didn't have an aide to bring my bed upstairs, so I had to stay there. And I wanted something to read, something, anything, just to take my mind off the other patients. And they weren't interested. So finally I grabbed the only thing available to read, which was my chart at the end of the bed. And 83 nurses converged on my bed and said, "You can't do that, dear," and took it out of my hands and walked away with me crying. I mean, I'm laughing at it now, but at the time I was just out of surgery and pretty upset. So I called after them, "I just want something to read," and they walked away as if I wasn't there. So I grabbed my chart again and started reading it. And they brought me a magazine, because you are not allowed to read your chart when you're a patient. Those things, all of them, all those stories, have a bearing on the subject, in the sense that over and over we are confronted with, when I listed the Senate and the House of Representatives and the Supreme Court as groups of men who think that they have the absolute right to say what happens to us, I left out.